Ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you to take your seats, please? I'm Ewan Graham. I'm the director of the International Security Programme here at the Institute. And today I'm delighted to welcome a panel to discuss the theme of China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is an area we've already had substantial interest and have published on within the last few months. Peter Tsai, who's now a non-resident fellow of the Institute, published on this, and it's one of our most downloaded publications. What we haven't had up until now really is a sort of sense of where the Belt and Road Initiative features in other countries and regions' perceptions. So I'm particularly happy that we've got Mathieu Duchâtel, who is the Deputy Director of the Asia and China Programme at the Council for European Foreign Relations, who's Paris-based but joining us here. Mathieu has also had a lot of experience in China over the years and previously worked in CIPRI, where their office resident in Beijing, and I've interacted with him on the circuit several times. So welcome. It's nice to bring you to Sydney, Mathieu. Dr. Meriden Viral, who is our East Asia Programme Director, who has also published recently an analysis on CGTN, the Chinese television network. So I'd encourage you all to download and have a look at that. It's all freely available on our website. And Meriden was in Beijing herself, where she worked for the UN Development Programme for several years. And covers China for us here at the Institute. And Professor Bates Gill, who is needs no introduction, but I will introduce you in any case. Bates is a world-renowned China expert and is now a professor at the Department for Security Studies and Criminology at Macquarie University in Sydney. And I'm thankful for you, Bates, for your role in bringing Mathieu to us as a guest today. And Bates and Mathieu also have a common linkage in CIPRI, where Bates was the director in Stockholm previously, one of his many illustrious roles in the past. So the Belt and Road Initiative has been around with us now for around 5 years, but there are still perhaps as many questions as there are answers about what the substance of it is, but that has certainly not prevented a surge of interest and questions, not just as to the kind of belt and braces infrastructural, economic quantity, but also the geopolitical motivations that underlie that. And perhaps maybe that's the way to introduce the European perspective on this, because European reactions to China generally, but to the Belt and Road, have also undergone something of a recent evolution. We've had the Prime Minister May of the UK, President Macron, who were, I think, asked and expected to sign on to the Belt and Road Initiative, but did not do so earlier this year. We also had the German Foreign Minister, German-China relations, I think, were one of the strongest, most positive, and yet quite strident tone in that speech just a couple of months ago, where the German Foreign Minister was calling out the difference in values between Europe and China. And a lot of this, I think, concentrates on what are the underlying motivations and implications of this colossal geostrategic undertaking that bears the umbrella title of the One Belt, One Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative. So Mathieu, maybe I can come to you first, just for your perspective. You're fresh from Paris. You cover this in great depth. Can you explain this shift in European perspective?
The three examples you mentioned, the refusal by the French President Macron, by the Prime Minister Theresa May, and then the speech at the Munich Security Conference by the German Foreign Minister, show that it's not a shift that is going on, but that the Western Europe has made up its mind regarding the response that should be given to the Belt and Road Initiative. And I think that the nature of the response is quite clear. It's not as enthusiastic as China would have hoped. This, despite a major public diplomacy campaign towards Western Europe, centered on Brussels and London by the Chinese side. It doesn't mean that Western European countries are rejecting cooperation with China on Belt and Road Initiative's projects. Actually, when President Macron came back to France, he instructed the French Foreign Ministry and other government agencies to look for possible cooperation projects or to label some existing projects as Belt and Road Initiative cooperation projects. And one of them is the Yamal gas extraction project in Siberia, where French and Chinese companies cooperate to extract gas. But beyond that, I think that there is a very strong perception in Europe that there is a question of whose terms, being engaged on Chinese terms or being able to engage China on our own terms. And there is an issue of whose terms that is at stake in the Belt and Road Initiative discussions that China has with Western Europe. Later during the year, the EU will publish its first strategy on connectivity, and it's supposed to make clear what are the principles, what are the norms, and what are the terms of the European Union to cooperate with third partners on connectivity projects. This is a response to the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, and this is because there is a very strong impression in Europe that China is imposing its terms on European countries. And there are examples already. For example, the Budapest-Belgrade railway. There is a question of being able to sustain European norms when it comes to Belt and Road Initiative projects. So I think that's the first thing. Then there is a very clear sense in Europe that the Belt and Road Initiative is a geopolitical project. So there is a reluctance to accept the Chinese narrative that it's about win-win and prosperity. It reflects the language in China when you read the work report by Xi Jinping to the 19th Party Congress. I think it makes very clear that the Belt and Road Initiative supports the Chinese ambitions for 2035 and 2050. So it's just a reaction to what the Chinese are actually saying. There is also on the economic side, questions regarding what is actually tangible in terms of possible benefits that European countries can get from cooperating with China on Belt and Road projects. There has been a lot of investment by Chinese companies, especially three of them. It's actually very concentrated in European ports. That is not something that European countries are rejecting. Most of them are financial investment. The only example of actually upgrading or building new infrastructure is in Greece. This is actually welcome, I think, by most states in Europe. But there are also questions regarding an increase of competition between China and European countries in the area of the blue economy. It's very obvious in the case of shipbuilding, actually. The example of luxury cruise ships, which I link to the Belt and Road Initiative, because especially the Maritime Silk Road part is about boosting the Chinese blue economy and transforming the scale of the Chinese blue economy from a regional dimension to a global dimension. And if you look at the perspective of the State Oceanic Administration and the National Development and Reform Commission, that are the two leading agencies for implementing the Belt and Road Initiative at sea, then you have a list of what are the most strategic sectors. Shipbuilding is one of them, offshore oil and gas exploitation, deep sea exploration. In all these areas, I think that there is a perception in Europe that as China will continue to roll out the Belt and Road Initiative project, this will create additional competition for European firms.
We started out by mentioning the change towards a more skeptical attitude from some of the larger member states. You mentioned Greece as the obvious one beneficiary in terms of infrastructure investment. Who are the other cheerers, if you like, for the Belt and Road in the EU? Do we find that there are other new accession states who still see it in rose-tinted as an an opportunity?
There is an interesting presence of Chinese companies in the Balkans, but these countries are out of the European Union. If you look at EU member states, I think that Greece and Hungary are obviously the most enthusiastic countries because these are the two countries that have received significant investment for, I hesitate to say game-changing projects, but infrastructure projects that really have an impact on their economy. For other states, especially in Western Europe, I think that the actual investment so far has been quite limited. But when you ask, you know, officials in China, this is only the beginning of the Belt and Road Initiative, right? And especially for the maritime one, the actual beginning of, you know, a strong push to invest in the blue economy globally and including in Europe is only starting in 2016. So the key area is only starting now.
Excellent. So we've got the European context. I notice you were nodding there, Meriden, at the end. I'd like you to give us a broader context of where this fits within China's frame of mind, its perceptions for how it's going out into the world. What is the underlying purpose and motivation, or are we maybe too guilty of overreading the motivations behind the Belt and Road? How do you see it?
Thanks. I think I think it's really important to remember that as a starting point, all Chinese policy at the top level is ultimately about CCP party legitimacy, maintaining and strengthening party legitimacy. So, and just remember that generally rests on two pillars. One, the Chinese people feel a strong sense of pride in their Chinese identity, a strong sense of belonging to that Chinese identity. And the second pillar is about material well-being, and that Chinese people feel and believe that their material well-being is increasing. Okay, so that is your overarching framework. The Belt and Road is no exception to this rule. When Xi Jinping announced it in 2013, it was branded as his project. It's branded as his legacy project. And it's based on an idea that development leads to stability and peace. And stability and peace is the foundational principle for further development, which comes into this whole idea of win-win, mutual benefit. And this is both a domestic idea and an international idea. So that the idea that development, stability, further development, that applies to within China in terms of Xinjiang, Tibet, other kind of restive regions that are underdeveloped and a little bit politically unstable, but also it applies to the region, the neighbourhood, and globally as well. So the idea is that you can calm and stabilise these difficult parts of China, and you can also create a peaceful international environment that comes back to be good for China, and that's recognised as a strategic priority. So there's four interlinked ways in which the BRI aims to achieve these. There's the domestic economic component, international economic component, the international political component, which Ewan referred to before as the BRI as a colossal geostrategic undertaking. I'd argue that that's just one component of the motivation for the BRI, and the domestic political component, and that's both a component as well as the overarching goal. Domestic economic component is about this, talking about poverty reduction in the Western areas. So since the opening up and reform in the 1970s, the eastern side of China has become remarkably developed. You know, Shanghai, Beijing, they're cosmopolitan metropolises, they're fabulous. But the West, Gansu, Xinjiang, Tibet, is still mired in really serious poverty, and that's not sustainable. Xi Jinping's made it a project for him. 2020, the country's going to be what he calls a moderately prosperous society. So that's a clear stated goal to get the rest of the population out of poverty. There's also economic purposes there of course, addressing the oversupply, overcapacity, and in particular moving surplus factories outside of China into other parts of the world, rather than sort of dumping products, although that getting products out is also a part of it. The international economic component, accessing markets, building supply chains, exporting Chinese technical and engineering standards to the rest of the world. Then we come to the international political component, the geostrategic component, which I think is overemphasized as being the driving force. It is a part of it, but it's not necessarily the only important part of it. So here we're talking about, you know, this idea that China is aiming to reshape some of the world, buy friends and influence, encourage others to look at the South China Sea in the way that it looks at the South China Sea, for example. some argue that the Belt and Road Initiative is a strategy to usurp the US as a dominant power regionally and globally. It does have a soft component built into it. There's a soft power component built into it. There's no doubt about that. Because one stated objective is that it's going to extend China's culture and civilization. And that's always about getting the rest of the world to see China as less threatening and more of a benevolent partner in global development, and to decrease fear and anxiety about China's increasing role in the world. And the last one, and I think this is really the most important one, is this domestic political component. The country has to believe that China, with CCP at the helm and Xi Jinping at the helm of the CCP, is delivering on rejuvenation, is delivering on building China back from this victimization narrative that's really been constructed and is widely believed, both ideologically and materially. The idea of the Silk Road, you know, branding it as the Silk Road is meaningful. You know, you could have this bunch of projects and you could call it anything, but it's called the Silk Road. And that's really part of this domestic political element, because the Silk Road harks back to this glorious time of the Tang Dynasty, you know, in 618 to 907, give or take, cultural high point, incredible epoch where both China was strong as a nation, but at the same time had a great relationship. This is this sort of historical narrative with the rest of the world. It was cosmopolitan, it was respected, it was open, but it was also a very strong country. And I just want to note that that's not the same as the tribute system. That was a different era. So there's not an overlap there. So that they're, I think, the main components building up into the overarching thing of CCP legitimacy, Xi Jinping's power. And I just want to quickly finish by saying, so far, I think the Chinese people seem reasonably satisfied with how that's going in terms of that domestic political project.
I just want to pick your brains on one question. One of the things that caught my eye among recent announcements from Chinese authorities was the creation of a dispute settlement court system, which suggests that there is an anticipation that not all will go swimmingly when it comes to Belt and Road investment projects. What's your take on that? To what extent does that sort of suggest that there is already a kind of the gloss varnish may be coming off the sort of positive narrative that you've just outlined?
I emphasise that the positive narrative is the domestic narrative within China. Internationally, you know, this Belt and Road was when it was announced, it was a kind of label for things that already existed. It's a pretty ad hoc bunch of projects that were retrospectively called Belt and Road, and then there's a whole lot of new projects that are coming under the label of Belt and Road. And China knows perfectly well that its investment projects overseas don't always go according to plan. There's been innumerable cases, for example, in Papua New Guinea where investment has gone very badly. The locals have blown up roads because they've been so dissatisfied with it. They need some kind of dispute mechanism, and they're obviously aware that this is going to be just as complicated.
Great, thank you. Bates Gill, I'd like to bring you in now for some further context setting. So we've heard really how it's seen from Europe, how the Chinese have framed their own initiative, but let's bring it a little bit closer home into the region. How do the regional countries that are perhaps more closely affected geographically interpreting the Quad, and to what extent is there an active response that's been considered? We've heard, for example, some reports about a kind of rival infrastructure plan among the so-called quadrilateral countries, Australia, India, Japan, and the United States. Where are things playing out, and do you think, is this really credible that the scale of China's endeavor can be matched?
Well, it is interesting how there is a very clear division regionally between countries that have, quote-unquote, signed on. We might want to talk about what that actually means. I think it's nothing more than really a political expression of interest and support to be a cooperative partner in one way or another. It's no more than that. Between countries that have done this, which I just learned from Mathieu, include even our friends in Pyongyang, North Korea, have signed on to the Belt and Road Initiative, and many, many others, obviously, versus those who I would include countries like the United States, India, very clearly. Australia has yet to formally provide that sort of political statement of interest to cooperate. And maybe a little bit of a fence straddler in this is Japan. That's, I think, playing both sides of the fence, to be honest. But it is interesting that there is this clear division. My sense is thus far that the reluctance on the part of countries like Australia and the United States and India and Japan as well, largely derives from these geopolitical concerns. On one hand, I think there's probably also an underlying concern about what the Belt and Road could mean in terms of economic competition. There's probably also, maybe in the case of Australia, for example, a little bit of lack of understanding of exactly how the Belt and Road would fit and contribute to Australian development, or how Australian firms could somehow insert themselves in usefully into projects under the Belt and Road initiative. So there's a variety of reasons for why this division has emerged. But I think it's pretty important when you're looking around the Asia-Pacific Rim that, you know, countries like the United States, Japan, Australia, and India are all expressing some pretty serious reservations about this project. I mean, that's quite serious, I would think. And to the degree that the leadership in Beijing is concerned about this, they're not letting on that they are, but obviously these are four extremely important geostrategic rivals, potentially, or geostrategic other countries of great importance in the region. So what are they doing? What are some of the responses then that we're seeing around the region that we could sort of judge to be counterbalancing or other forms of partnering in juxtaposition to the BRI? Well, at the top of the list is this notion of the Quad, the idea which has been with us for a long time, well before the initiation of the Belt and Road, that these like-minded democratic states in the Asia-Pacific, and in particular the four, Japan, United States, Australia, and India, ought to be partnering on a variety of projects and seeking common goals, largely, in theory at least, based upon the fact that they are democracies. I'm a bit skeptical about it, at least at that level, because it's just been so difficult to move beyond that rhetorical point of view. I was more encouraged during President Trump's trip to the region late last year that something a little bit more concrete seemed to be in formation, that was going to be a kind of Quad economic development and infrastructure development project. To me, that makes a lot of sense, because you would be complementing the Belt and Road Initiative. One of the reasons why the Quad at a political level has never worked is because all four of those capitals in the Quad, in one way or another, don't want to get on the wrong side with China. I mean, they want to have at least a constructive relationship, even if we have concerns. But if it looks like containment to Beijing, well, then it's going to be problematic. But if it's an economic project, infrastructure development, goodness knows the infrastructure needs in the Asia-Pacific go well beyond what even China can hope to address. So a complementary project that's working on economic development, infrastructure development, one in which these four countries and maybe some other like-minded partners would feel more comfortable in applying their terms, their norms. And yes, it might even have geostrategic and international economic and domestic political benefits, just as the BRI does for China. It makes a lot of sense to me. As far as I can see, it's going nowhere. It's just going nowhere because, unfortunately, I don't think the United States is in much of a position politically or financially to pour a lot of resources into this. Japan may well be very keen to pursue this, and probably Australia as well, but neither of those countries have, I don't think, the sorts of economic wherewithal and financial instruments quite yet to compete fully with what the BRI purports to be able to achieve. But I'm hopeful that we can maybe get our governments to think harder about this economic infrastructure development initiative on the part of these four countries, because I think it makes a lot of sense to try and pursue. And in the meantime, you have a lot of these more individual country programs like Japan trying to get more active in infrastructure development in the region. But it does, I don't think it adds up quite yet to being an effective complementary alternative to what the Belt and Road is purporting to do.
Part of the problem, it seems to me, is that there just hasn't been really another game out there. That even if countries might have their own concerns about some of the qualitative issues around the type of investment that China is offering, it's simply there is no alternative in many cases. Do you think, particularly in the case of the United States, that there is, even if there's an understanding at the strategic level in some quarters that the need that the U.S. has to be present economically in the region, but politically, President Trump, of course, in the campaign himself, attached particular importance to upgrading U.S. domestic infrastructure, would that make it too difficult for him to sell as a foreign policy idea if really what he's committed to is building roads, railways, and walls close to home?
Well, I think it is a politically challenging proposition for President Trump, like a lot of other propositions. I mean, I think it looks good at first, and the idea seems to capture his attention. But then, then the details rather rudely emerge upon the scene and make it a lot more difficult to execute. I suppose if it could be structured in one way or another, for example, production of American equipment, right, for export for these development projects, that might be one way of framing it, that the president could justify the investments that would be needed out in the region. But to be honest, I don't think he has thought even that far about what this notional economic and infrastructure development partnership might even look like.
I don't want to take too much time away from the opportunity for you, the audience, to ask your own questions, but maybe as a segue into that question and answer part, I'd like to interrogate Mathieu a little bit more about the different aspects of the Belt and Road Initiative. There is clearly a continental aspect to it, the resource-rich but population-poor stans to the west of China that connect out the hinterland between China and Europe, but also clearly, as you've identified in your framing comments, a lot of the momentum is with the maritime part of the Silk Road Initiative, investment in ports, in which Europe seems to be directly connected up. This also sort of recalls basic geopolitical theory. We have the well-known theorist Halford Mackinder, who identified the importance of the Eurasian heartland as being the key to global dominance. And alternative ideas dating back again some time, such as Nicholas Spykman and the idea of the Rimland as actually being more important, because that's where in the maritime periphery of Eurasia, that's where the populations, the wealth, and the connectivity has been concentrated. And I think maybe the lesson of history in the 20th century tended to favor those that were more connected by sea. Is that a lesson that China has consciously absorbed and inserted into its investment in the Belt and Road Initiative? Where do you see these two different strands playing out? Which one has more momentum? Which is more important?
If you are in Beijing, or if you are in Western Europe, what gets the most attention is trains. The new train lines, or the new container trains from many Chinese cities to many European cities. That really gets a lot of media attention because it's new, even though the railways are not. But if you look at the trade statistics from on China-EU trade, actually trains, even in 2017, represented only 2% of the overall EU-China trade. And ships is at more than 60%. And these percentages are completely stable. It means that the real story economically is about, you know, increasing the volume of shipping. And in fact, if you look at the cost of shipping a container from China to Europe by train and by sea, containers by sea remain less expensive. It's about, I think, $800 for one container from Shanghai to any port city in Western Europe. Containers by trains are around $1,000 per container, but it's heavily subsidized by the Chinese local governments. So the actual cost may be 3 to 4 times more than the cost for the trading company. So there is a political project to completely change the cost of trade by train on the Chinese side. But it's highly doubtful that in the next 5 years there will be a major change regarding that. And even though they managed to decrease the cost of shipping containers by train, they will still face the problem of congestion on the Russian border, changing gauges from the Chinese system to the Russian system, and then again from the Russian system to the European system. So it's a major challenge. So for me, the real economic story is really about the Maritime Silk Road. Then if you look at the geopolitical dimension, I also think that the real geopolitical story, at least from a European perspective, is in the Indian Ocean. Because on the land dimension, on the Eurasian mass land, the Chinese projects are really primarily, in terms of geopolitical implications, about managing the China-Russia relationship, about deepening the partnership, about managing different views in Central Asia. But when it comes to the Indian Ocean, then it has an impact on Europe's relations with a number of states, primarily India, very clearly in the case, especially in the case of France and the UK, Djibouti, Sri Lanka. It changes the nature of the geopolitics of the Indian Ocean.
You mentioned there managing the China-Russia relationship, and you earlier referenced the Yamal liquefied natural gas project as one maritime spur in that. But if it's predominantly a continental question between China and Russia, is there a tension there? Because Russia clearly historically has seen a lot of what encompasses this land-based Silk Road as its hinterland.
So far, what I see is that the Chinese and the Russians have successfully managed their initially different views on China's infrastructure projects in Central Asia. I also see that Russia is increasingly accepting a Chinese security presence in Central Asian states through arms sales, but also through a larger presence in Tajikistan. So I think that there is sufficient trust between the two sides for the Russians to not undermine the Chinese projects in Central Asia.
Excellent. So ladies and gentlemen, I'd now like to throw it open to the floor for your questions. Could you please identify yourself, keep your question as short and to the point as possible, and please wait for the microphone to come to you. I saw a lady in the front row first. We'll take a couple first of all. After that, Charlie Lyons-Jones.
Hi, I'm Jackie Range. I wanted to ask you what you think about the consequences of debt. China's owed money for some of these infrastructure facilities that are being built, and I'm thinking particularly about Sri Lanka. Is that part of the strategy? Is that good or bad or both?
Charlie Lyons-Jones from the Institute.
Before the Belt and Road Initiative was unveiled, China was active in developing multilateral institutions. One example is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, another is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. What role are these multilateral institutions supposed to play in the Belt and Road Initiative?
Okay, who would like to take the question on debt first? It wasn't addressed to a particular panelists, so I'll throw it open to who would like to have first crack at that.
You noted the case of the Sri Lankan port. It is very, very interesting. What you end up having in Sri Lanka then is when the local authorities were unable to service their debt, In comes the Chinese state-owned company to take over ownership and operation of the at a loss, presumably, but nevertheless, with the benefit of then having Chinese control over that port, and ultimately it would become profitable with time, I'm sure. So they'll see their money at some point. But so it does raise a lot of questions about whether that was purposeful. probably there's some. There may well be some underlying strategy in trying to, you know, assert Chinese influence by, you know, having to swoop in and solve countries' debt problems. But I don't think it's I wouldn't think that it's a sort of priority. I think by and large, much of what the Belt and Road represents is commercial in nature, and it's going to be. I mean, I think the better outcome obviously would be. Not only to, through economic engagement, gain the political benefit that would come from Belt and Road, but also to do it with a profit, and not just throw money down bad ideas. But you know, in any development effort, there's always going to be projects that don't work well, and I think it's also the case in China is a peculiar case in that. You know, there's this real need that they have to try and export their debt, export their overcapacity. So there probably is a higher tolerance for projects that might not go as well. But I don't think that it's a purposeful undertaking because it strikes me that in countries like Sri Lanka or Djibouti or smaller economies like that. You're already probably gaining a fair bit in terms of diplomatic and political presence, even if the projects go well. So wouldn't you prefer that you get the political influence and that the projects go well and you don't end up having to bail out the country's debt?
I think China's understanding of development, going back to that as one of the purposes, is very kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So you've got the kind of the material thing component at the bottom. So infrastructure, from the Chinese perspective of development, is absolutely essential for development to take place. Our kind of traditional donor way of looking at it is that governance and democracy and those things are essential for development. So it's a bit of the other way around. In order to achieve infrastructure, in order to achieve development, sometimes you need to go into debt. So from the Chinese point of view, debt is an essential, unavoidable component of investing for development. It's how they work in China. There's a lot of debt from infrastructure development in China, and it's not necessarily seen in quite the same way as we understand it from here. Additionally, in some of these small countries, they are already in debt distress. The IMF or other actors decide, rightly or wrongly, that they don't want to add to that debt distress. If these countries want, the Maldives as an example, more infrastructure for what they see as their development potential, China's going to be the one who's going to do it. So there's an argument, and I don't really know how economically robust that argument is, that debt is a useful means for building the investment for further development. The Center for Global Development just recently wrote a report about China's debt and the debt distress, and it noted that for BRI, and it noted that I think there was 8 countries out of the over 68 countries that China was engaged with that may be at risk of serious debt distress. So it's actually a smaller proportion than we might imagine.
Great. And Mathieu, you wanted to chime in.
I just have something very quickly on the debt. The Indian scholar, Brahmashalane, coined the term debt trap diplomacy. I think it's a little bit exaggerated. I tend to agree that there's absolutely no compelling evidence that there is an intention on the Chinese side to promote debt for equity swaps, as we saw in Sri Lanka. But at the same time, I think that the Sri Lankan example is also a lesson for countries that are accepting such projects.
Bates, maybe I can throw the second question to you first.
As I understand it, not just the AIIB, but the China Development Bank, the New China Bank, the New Development Bank of China, these are all being seen as sources of financing for Belt and Road Initiative projects. I think maybe you follow this a lot more closely, Marina, but I think there are a number of examples of the AIIB already providing financing. So I think that's what the that's where the relationship will work. So the Belt and Road is really, I would say, a sort of overarching scheme or rubric under which almost any development project that China undertakes, you know, around the rim and the Eurasian landmass could be sort of categorized. And then it becomes a question of the partners of that project looking for financing. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know if there's an example, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Asian Development Bank could come forward and provide financing for what would be labeled a Belt and Road Initiative. In fact, there may be an example of it. I'm not sure.
Maybe I'll just tweak it. Did China learn any lessons out of the AIIB experience that it's now going to apply to the Belt and Road Initiative? I mentioned earlier the decision to set up this dispute settlement mechanism, but those, of course, are going to be under Chinese sovereignty within China's borders. But did China conclude that actually it let the horse escape too far with the AIIB, and that there's going to be a more national ownership approach to this? Or
from a Chinese angle, the AIIB is a very positive story. I mean, politically, the intention was probably not to create a division internationally between the US and Japan on the one hand, Western Europe on the other hand, but that's how it evolved in practice. So it forced countries to actually take a clear stance over something that in the beginning was a bank to support infrastructure projects and not, you know, a strategy to create a divisions in the international community. So it forced countries to actually show their hand regarding the Belt and Road Initiative. But when you look at AIIB projects now, I think that for me, at least, it's quite clear that China has taken on board some of the initial criticism that was directed at what could become the AIIB. It's actually a funding project in cooperation with other institutions. It's not, you know, dominating the whole project that it is funding. So overall, but I think we should not overestimate the importance of the AIIB in the whole BRI story, because it's one of many different actors. And to come back actually to the question on multilateral organizations, I think that most of the projects, most of the initiatives that actually are implemented are at the bilateral level. I mean, it's a sum of bilateral relations, and in some cases, like in Sri Lanka, Greece, Djibouti, maybe, you know, in the coming years, Thailand and Malaysia, you see investments that transform the nature of the political relationship that China has with those states. So for me, it's really the bilateral dimension that is essential in the Belt and Road Initiative.
And a positive learning so far, from the sound of it, from China's perspective.
A positive learning. There is a degree of success in several states, but there is also a pushback that China increasingly has to face. So I think it's a mixed balance sheet.
And they're quite different entities as well. I mean, the AIIB is an institution. The Belt and Road Initiative, trying to compare the two is rather difficult, because the Belt and Road Initiative is an enormous mass of ad hoc projects, and there are so many different actors. It's there are provincial level governments, there are SOEs, there are so many different actors. So it's hard to say that, you know, it can learn a lesson from the AIIB when there is no it per se.
I saw two hands raised, both in the front row, gentlemen there and gentlemen there.
Hi, Jonathan Ping from Bond University, and also the East Asia Security Centre, which is associated with CFAU. We probably both know Professor Su. Thank you very much. It was a great comprehensive discussion from all four of you. I'm really interested in going a little bit further and asking you some fairly specific questions about competition, geostrategic, geopolitical, between the China dream and the Indo-Pacific concept. And CIS is interested in that. And I'm also interested, maybe pushing a little bit further than that, and asking you what do you think the implications for the narrative of the dream is with the recent removal of the two-term limits. So that's my two questions. Thank you very much.
Brian Everingham, Institute of International Affairs. I think it's a bit of a follow-up for that last question, but in discussion regarding the Quad, I was wondering to what extent the TPP version 2 complicates the issue in relation to China's BRI.
I think that maybe, Bates, those questions sort of come logically to you first.
Very, very big ones. I mean, I think it's probably too early yet to concretely assess or try to draw clear understanding of sort of the so-called free and open Indo-Pacific concept, which President Trump and others have recently put forward, versus some sort of a China-led concept about how countries should be governed and how economies ought to be run and all the rest. But I think it's coming, and I think we see in the tensions erupting on the economic front between the United States and China, that underlying much of that, I think, is a concern in the United States that China is putting forward a sort of different framework or a different conceptualization about how the world should work, both at a domestic level as well as internationally. So I think the tensions are definitely on the rise, and it's going to be very, very interesting for international relations observers to see just how effective either side can be in promoting, because I mean, I think they both have their weaknesses, to be quite honest. On the one hand, I think when Xi Jinping is being held up as the icon of globalization, for example, I find that just laughable, given the internal controls which he has so effectively and even ruthlessly put in place in his own country, precisely to prevent the outside world from having what he would view as a deleterious and undermining effect on the longevity and legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. On the other hand, we too in the West, I think, have to acknowledge that we are guilty of hypocrisy and a bit of flimsy commitment to this idea of a free and open world or Indo-Pacific. We're seeing the very notion of a liberal economic and political order being attacked every day, and not just in Washington, in capitals of purportedly liberal democracies all around the world. So that's a problem.
Sorry to cut in, but I thought that was a good point to bring Mathieu in from a European perspective, because the question was asked primarily in terms of contending US and Chinese narratives, but that in a way tells its own story that there isn't a European narrative that one automatically grasps towards. Is that also a penny that's now dropping in European capitals, that Europe has been too passive so far in its approach towards the China question in general, and needing to frame its own economic narrative towards Asia as a positive alternative, and one that complements this idea of rules-based, free and open?
Well, the discussion on the sustainability of the rules-based liberal international order is very vivid in Europe. There are many discussions going on, including with Japan in particular, I would say. But I don't see an intention to actually promote a third narrative between the free and open Indo-Pacific on the one hand and the China dream on the other hand. But what I see is first that China has a win in terms of shaping the discussion. I mention that because it has been something that Chinese intellectuals have focused on for a very long time, how to promote an idea that actually gets attention. And I think that with the Belt and Road Initiative, they have that, even if it is divisive, even if, it's not endorsed by all states, and actually there is a reluctance to endorse this narrative on the part of many states. At the same time, I think that the free and open Indo-Pacific is appealing to a number of states in Western Europe. That you know, this is part of the strategic discussion. Clearly, you know, Western Europe is not part of the Quad. This is not how the discussion is evolving, but it's there as an idea. It resonates quite positively with the views that are held, especially I would say in Paris and London, regarding UNCLOS in particular, and the maritime order based on international law. So Europe may be on the passive receiving end of these initiatives, but these initiatives are part of the discussion, really, and shaping the thinking regarding our impact in the region.
Now, the question was also asked about the end of two-term limits. Maybe, Merida, I'll come to you and ask you, to what extent, seeing as the initiative coincides with the beginning of Xi Jinping's term in office, how much of the Belt and Road is personally associated with the Chinese president, and what impact will that have on how it develops?
It's become entirely associated with the Chinese president, I think, but because he has made it so. As I said before, when he launched it in 2013, he labelled it as part of his strategy to achieve the China dream and Chinese rejuvenation. So he's made it about him. So with the removal of the two-term limit and the high likelihood that he will continue to stay on as president into the future, I mean, it seems logical that we're just going to see more of this kind of rejuvenation narrative, this kind of nationalist rhetoric that we saw at the closing of the Congress just recently. It's, you know, we're going to see more of him doing more of what he's been doing. And that's part of the China dream. The China dream is a huge part of that, and that rejuvenation narrative is part of that. And if I can skip back a bit quickly to the previous question about that competition between the China dream and the Indo-Pacific concept, the rejuvenation narrative, this China dream narrative, is about China resuming its rightful, inverted commas, role in the region. What that means in practice is kind of hard to be sure about. What we know, what we can see is, say, for example, behaviour in the South China Sea, behaviour in the East China Sea. If China wants sovereignty over those islands or rocks, what does that, in fact, then mean after that's been achieved? So to what extent there's going to be competition, in exactly what way there's going to be competition between free and open Indo-Pacific and China, we talk about it a lot. You know, China's challenge to the liberal order, the international order, but what that actually means in practice, we don't know.
Hi, my name's Michael Finley. I'm not representing anybody but myself, but I would like you to, that last comment you made about the South China Sea, and maybe the panel to extend on that a little bit, and the idea to try and link the comments you made. It would be nice if the emphasis was so much on the domestic rationale for all of what's happening, but the muscular degree of militarization and making facts on the ground in the South China Sea might arguably play against that. So what I wanted to ask perhaps the panel more broadly is, are we engaged in a process of long-term appeasement? So in other words, are we entering a phase where we're all standing back and interpreting what China's doing, but there isn't a lot actually happening that will change the course of what's happening in the South, and in particular, the Philippines that had won the only case that might have changed that course is now politically showing every evidence that it has been persuaded by China not to prosecute that case. So interested in your comments.
The Philippines does not actually lie formally, I think, within the terms of the Belt and Road Initiative. Not yet, anyway.
Hi, I'm Alex Bristow from the British High Commission. The Foreign Policy White Paper here in Australia talks a lot about openness to all kinds of infrastructure projects, provided they meet international standards and are transparent in the way investments are made. Is that the right approach? And is there any clarity going forward on what those international standards might be?
So the broader strategic question and the underlying question of whether there is an appeasement risk in embracing the BRI, maybe also if panelists could include whether there is a military component within any of these investments that China has undertaken. We haven't answered that question, but if you could take those together as a parcel, and then standards around investment.
Gentleman's question here, I wanted to also, and it had to do with the Quad, if I remember correctly. Right. Well, I'm very encouraged by what's transpired with the new, what's a comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CPTPP. I'm encouraged, and I think it was with a few bumps along the way, wisely structured, that would allow for the reentry of the United States and China, for that matter, at some point down the road. And we know that these multilateral trade agreements sort of have this never-ending life of their own. And so, if we're patient, and if the right political constellations align, I think, and for those of you who support multilateral free trade agreements, I think we'll be happier as time goes on. I'm relatively optimistic that can be the case. I don't see it undermining the idea of a rules-based, free and open, liberal economic form of governance for this part of the world. Can I just put on the appeasement question? It's very, very interesting. You know, that's a very loaded term, obviously. It harkens back to notions of Chamberlain and Hitler. And I see something very, very different going on here. And primarily because the major countries who could actually stand up to and even confront China's actions do not have a fundamental strategic interest to do so. What I mean by that is an interest that's so powerful that you are prepared to have your men and women die for that interest. And we look back now with the benefit of 80 years of history to the Sudetenland and so forth, and we can say, well, clearly that was something at the time. So that's the problem, fundamentally. The U.S. interest is to have open sea lanes, to be able to operate wherever international law allows. So far, China hasn't said that that's not going to happen. They haven't said that won't happen yet. If they do attempt to try and shut down that stated interest of the United States, well, then we'll find out whether or not it is one of such a level that the United States is prepared to go to war with China. But right now, that's not where we are. If there are appeasers out there, it's the countries whose territory is in dispute with China. And I don't see them pushing hard against the Chinese claims.
Mathieu, you're our guest today from all the way from Paris, so I think right. The last word.
Okay, then very quickly. On the question of standards, it resonates with the discussion in Europe. I think that one part of the response to the Belt and Road Initiative is about enforcing norms in Europe regarding infrastructure projects. This is a very sane and a response that makes sense. On the military dimension, it's very clear that there is a naval component to the Belt and Road Initiative. The Djibouti naval base, entirely controlled by the PLA Navy, even though it is centered, you know, on providing support for anti-piracy, providing support for humanitarian assistance missions, and also as a pivot point for peacekeeping. I mean, it's very clear that if you connect it to the discussion in China, it's about the protection of Chinese overseas interests. The discussion is also evolving towards, using the Navy strategically to protect Chinese interests across the world. I think that this dimension is quite essential, and the link between economy and security, naval power is increasingly obvious. I'll just end on, you know, what has been the European response so far. Appeasement is a very strong word indeed. I think that the response in Europe is centered on European interest in Europe to a very large degree, but there is a response, and it is a response to investment in general through the adoption of an investment screening mechanism at some point during the year in 2018, a more defensive approach on trade issues with the adoptions of new rules on anti-subsidy and anti-dumping. There is also a diversification of Europe's ties in the Asia-Pacific region and a shift in the discussion that was very much centered on China to a more regional discussion that takes into account, you know, the interest of other partners in the region. These are three elements that are very concrete and that result of Chinese Chinese activity on the Belt and Road Initiative.
Good sharp point to end on. And I'm struck from all of our three panelists that we're not just talking in terms of a region. Eurasia is in itself perhaps more than a continent, but a mega region. But we're also talking now about a global level involvement and interest. And I note that although it hasn't been mentioned, within the Belt and Road Initiative, we even have a Central American component now with the Panama and proposed Nicaraguan canal. So I think that's the broad sweep that includes both Asia. We didn't have a chance to talk about Australia today, but something that links in China's initiative, everything from Europe through Djibouti, Central America to Australia, the scale and scope of the ambitions behind the Belt and Road Initiative should not be underestimated, and I'm sure we will be back before long to discuss further this on-running issue. It just remains for me to thank my three panelists for their excellent contributions, and please thank them in the usual way.